we see them cut to a cafeteria. Yep,
the commissary.
Right. There's a guy in there by the name of Joey who's in full Hitler outfit.
Yeah, yes.
they said, how much longer are they going to need you? And he says...
only until the bunker scene. Oh, my God, Mel, what did you do?
I do not mind laughing at that joke.
Now we cut to the
line of baddies.
Yeah, I call them all the riffraff. not excluding KKK members.
Oh yeah,
and there's a camel.
Yeah, they got like people who are on, like, it's supposed to be like a motorcycle gang.
Yeah, but like the long handled Mexican motorcycle gangs.
Yeah.
Okay, and then some other like Mexican guys with guns and stuff, and some Asian guys with the Chinese style hats on, and
yeah,
it looks bad.
They got,
and then something about badges. They're like having to fill out paperwork, and the Mexican guy gets to the front of the line, and he's all like,
Before that, we see at the very end of the line, we have a couple of people in KKK robes, and they say, "Have a nice day" on the back of them. But you mean
you can hate some people that you don't know for very non-specific judgy reasons, and even if you do something nice also, it doesn't save you from being a bigoted douchebag?
Correct.
You mean that even if you were a Nazi but you gave somebody a flower, you'd still be a f***ing Nazi?
It's like in the Doctor Who episode where he, do you remember the, it was the first season of the remake of Doctor Who with Christopher Eccleston? Yeah, he goes to Cardiff and there's like an alien who like has human skin on her, and she comes from this like gangster style alien family. And like this family is featured in a two-parter where they're trying to take over the UK. And then later on in Cardiff, she's trying to create this nuclear power plant to power a spaceship so she can get back to her family. But she doesn't kill a woman who's married and is going to have a kid. And she uses that as reason, as like, I can be good because I didn't do it this one time. And the doctor says, yeah, that's how you justify your crappy behavior. You didn't do it to one person. You do the smallest amount and you think that makes you good, but it really doesn't. Anyways,
that is not wrong.
That wasn't my original point. My original point is they see these guys in white robes and they're like, Jim's like, I got an idea. And so Bart goes behind the rock and he's like, hey, boys. And then they turn around and he pulls out Bart. And do you remember what he says? Hey, where are the white women at? And they both go up behind the rock. And then the KKK members go behind the rock and they get beat up. And that's when we see the line with the horrible Mexican stereotypes and the
sign here to get your badges. And then it's like, badges. And I'm not even going to fake the accent. Badges. We don't need no stinking badges. And I'm like, from UHF that came out so many years after this?
Yeah. And do you remember Zombie Strippers?
They say it in that too?
Yeah. But it wasn't badges and it wasn't badgers. Maybe it was badges in that one too. But so this is a gen fact. I actually did some research very quickly on this one. And it's originally from a 1948 movie. And the original quote, this is sort of like, Luke, I am your father, in that it's not the actual quote.
Is it a mandala effect situation?
No, it really is it's the heart of the quote is there. The spirit of the quote is there. Badges, we ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges. That's the original. And we don't need no stinking badges in this film. And it is also referenced in a Monkees 1967 episode by Mickey. And if I show you that picture, do you still like the Monkees after they've dressed up in those outfits? It makes me sad how many people have appropriated Mexican culture and not only appropriated it, but cartoonishly done so.
Okay, but raise your hand if you went to Azteca and wore the hat.
No.
Oh, for sure.
No.
You've never had to wear the sombrero?
No, I think I don't remember ever having to wear the sombrero. I think I specifically requested at one point. I remember going to Azteca for my birthday and specifically requesting because I knew about it. I was just like, I don't really want to wear the hat. But that I don't think was because I didn't want to appropriate Mexican culture. It was because I just didn't want that kind of attention.
You're not a spectacle type of person.
Yeah,
That's not okay.
I'm not gonna, you know, dress up in costume to go to Comic-Con or even Halloween. Like my Halloween costume was always cat ears. But that was when I was younger. As I get older, the more I'm like, no, I'm just going to go as like a podcaster, or I'm going to go as a cleaner, or I'm going to go as someone who watches YouTube videos.
I'm going as a serial killer. They look just like everyone else.
I would like to do a Halloween costume where it's just me with a romance novel. Like you get a romance novel that's like 300 pages and people have to pick a number between 1 and 300. Uh-huh. And then you open it up and then you read like a paragraph from it.
Do you want to end the podcast this week with that? Because I've got so many romance novels over there.
It has to be a costume for like Halloween. That I think would be pretty clever. And that wouldn't cause me to, you know, have to dress up, which like, ugh. But what's important around this time with this horrible Mexican stereotype is that Lamar specifically states you want to be there at noon tomorrow. So then the next people after the Mexican gunslingers is the two KKK members.
Yes.
And then Bart goes ahead and they're like, what do you do? And it's like, oh, we stampede cattle. And they're like, that's not too difficult. And he's like, through the Vatican. And he was like, kinky. So they were like, sign here. And so Bart pulls out his hands and, you know, it's obvious that they're a black man's hands. And so Jim's like, oh, you gotta wash your hands before you or after you do those cross burnings. And then they pull the hoods off and reveal the people. Uh-huh. And then they make their he said, now let me do an impression of Jesse Owens. And then he goes running.
He's a famous runner, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay, so they sneak into the camp, right? And he puts his hand over his bestie's Charlie's mouth. Mm-hmm. And he's like, say hello. Uncovers his mouth. Hello. Covers his mouth. He goes, I need you to get everyone you can together and meet us at midnight at such and such a place.
Mm-hmm.
And
grab as much wood and paint that you can and all the tools that you can carry.
Now say goodbye. Uncovers his mouth. Goodbye. And then he leaves.
Right. And then Charlie starts waking everybody else up. And
yes, I call this the gathering of two companies.
Right.
So we've got Jim and Bart. And then we've got Charlie, who's with all the black guys.
But they don't show up just yet. It's Jim and Bart with the town. And the town's like, why did you bring us out here in the middle of the prairie
That's
at this
right.
ungodly hour? And he's like, well, this is my plan. We're going to go ahead. We're going to make a duplicate town, east of where the current town is. Everybody's going to go in there and we're going to ambush them in there. We're going to fight them there. So that way the town doesn't get destroyed. And they're like, you expect us to do that in the middle of the night with like, we don't have enough people to do that. And he's like, right. That's why I was talking about them. And he points to Charlie and Charlie and all of them come up. And then you see like the town who's like kind of in front of Jim and Bart where the camera is positioned. And then you see all of those people go to one side as Charlie and the others come in on the other into the other. So there's this obvious divide between the two groups.
Yes. And then the lawyer guy, right? Like he's like a would be mayor type.
He's the one who says authentic frontier gibberish. And he has this whole big speech towards the beginning.
Yes.
He's another Johnson.
He's like, fine, we'll take the N-words and the C-words, the Asian slur words, right?
Yeah, because they got the Chinese railway workers, too.
Right. And he's like, but not the Irish. And all of the people from the work camp, the railroad camp, are like, rah, 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 rah. Yeah.
Like
and,
everyone.
Yeah, I think, is it Bart who says it or is it Charlie who's like, it's all of us or none of us?
I think it's Charlie saying everybody. And Bart says, no deal. And that's when the guy's like, okay.
I guess the Irish get in on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah.
So they got a fake town. They got a stupid posse. But they need fake townspeople.
Right.
And so they set up a diversion, which is a tollway charging 10 cents per person. It's one outpost in the middle of the desert.
And
they all stop.
Yeah. They're like, we got to go back and we got to get 10 cents. Oh, and it has like a light on there that says exact change or... It's like it has like, you know, one where it says exact change and there's like a red or a green and it's on the red. So it's like indicating they need exact change. So they need like a dime per person.
Yes.
And so they go, and it's like they
pat their pockets. That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. But there's nothing stopping them from going around. These men are just dumb.
Some of them, I mean, it feels like the tiny bridge gag from Men in Tights. So like, I love that Mel Brooks is like, he says what we've always thought, like, there's the problem. You can easily go around it, but you've chosen not to.
Right.
So.
As in, you can acknowledge your racism. You can acknowledge your bigotry. And you can try and, you know, find a way around it instead of, like, holding on to this ideal that you have to go down this road.
All right, applauders. This is where all of our notes start this downhill sweep because it's all action. All of the gags are very visual or very, like, very passing.
Right.
And not in a bad way. I certainly like this kind of chaotic comeuppance.
Right.
To a very clear and not overly, like, not a heavy blow ending. Let's just go with it.
Okay. Bad guys go into the town.
It's the dummy town with the dummy people.
Right. And so, very obviously, by the way, and Bart goes to set off dynamite, which is going to explode around them.
With a plunger.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't go off. And so Jim has to make...
crack shots.
Yeah.
It's all come down to, of course, you know, not... And it's not, it doesn't feel like a white savior sort of way.
Mm-hmm. It's more just, like you're getting your groove back.
He's got the skill.
Yeah.
The bomb didn't go off. Mm-hmm. Could happen to anyone.
Right.
We got to have him shoot this thing.
Right.
And he's certainly not the hero of this film.
No.
It's all Bart.
Right. Just whenever they need someone who can shoot really well, that's when they pull out their Jim.
Okay. So they're like, one guy in the fake town goes, it's fake! And like pulls down a wall. And that's when Jim makes the shot. Things start blowing up, including, okay, some horses fall over, like real life horses fall over. And I'm mad about that. But if you want to hear me be really mad about that, you can go listen to 13th Warrior. Or if you'd like to hear a rebuttal for why I should be less mad about it, but probably still mad about it, you can listen to the Shock Talk about that. But so like 2-3 horses fall down. I look away quickly. But they do show horses being blown up into the air. There's like 2 horses that go flying. They're obviously dummies, but it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, like, if you're going to be blowing up animals, they're going to be blown up.
Right. And then everybody outside the town, everybody associated with the town goes in and they all start fighting like,
it's time for serious brawl number 2.
Right. And speaking of fake horses, we do have a moment where Mongo punches a horse and it topples backwards and it's very obviously a fake horse.
Yes.
But it's up close and I love it.
So the brawl gets bigger and bigger. Old lady gets punched. Old lady be punching. Like, everyone's going at it. And
Lily Stupper is singing with the German soldiers because of course they have Nazis in there.
Yes, yes. Oh, and there's a weird part way earlier where Lamar makes them all pledge to him and like the German shoulders like giving the Sieg Heil. Ugh, it's weird. Okay, so they're having this big fight and it pans out and you realize that they're not on some Western street. They're in the middle of is it a town? Is it a city? No, it's a movie lot. And you're like, oh, that really broke every wall for me.
Right.
Awesome. But then it cuts into what I call the Tux number.
Yeah.
And there, who do we have in there?
Dom DeLuise.
He's directing like this. He's like, wrong, wrong to these guys.
Yeah, he's very obviously a flamboyant gay director who is like telling them that they're dancing wrong.
Yes. And he's like, let me show you. 5, 6, 7, 8. Ta, 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 ta.
Yeah.
The name of Don DeLuise's character, Buddy Bazaar, is a reference to the famed dance choreographer Busby Berkeley, who was renowned for staging highly elaborate and precisely timed song and dance numbers, of which The French Mistake is a parody.
Oh, well, it's also funny because they make a mistake in the filming, and then when the director comes in to show them how to do it, he makes a mistake. So, and as they're finishing off
And he says, watch me, F slurs.
Yeah. It's bad.
But that's okay because you know what?
They end up getting into a fight with the fight from the town.
The wall falls in.
Right.
And the brawl sprawls in with it.
Yeah. And the director, Buddy, does go ahead and stops it. And he's just like, what are you doing on my picture? You need to get out of here. This is a close set. And then one of the top henchmen punches him in the face. And one of the dancers says, he hit Buddy. Get him. And so the tuxedo guys are coming in and they're fighting.
Says, let's get them, girls.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. But I don't necessarily hate that. Yeah. I will misgender people that I know and love on purpose. Not in a derogatory way.
Right.
But like, I will turn to my nephew and be like, girl, you know?
Yeah.
Or I'll refer to like a little girl and babysit. I'll be like, my guy, come on. You know, like that stuff doesn't matter. Like in amongst your friends, I assume lots of dance troops, especially like these ones, mm-hmm. would be very close and probably even contract.
Right.
And so like the fact that he's like, let's get them, girls. And no one looks offended. They're like, yeah, someone's f***ing with us. We got to get them.
Right. The cringe comes from the fact that you're seeing these dancers and it's like, again, kind of treating gay men as, you know, feminine. And like the constant stereotype of that.
Yeah. Yes. Oh. I will say that is a little upsetting. I've met an entire spectrum. I've met straight passing gay men. I've met gay passing straight men. Like the way with which you present yourself is not a factor in your orientation, you know, and obviously not it, or it should be obvious, but mm-hmm. not within your occupation.
Right.
You know?
So, and everybody's kind of getting at it and they're fighting.
Oh man, the fighting.
There is, you see a cowboy and a tuxedo guy. They start fighting and then they go behind the set. And then when they come out on the other side.
My car's actually parked in the lot outside.
Right. And then you see a tuxedo guy just like banging on the chest of a cowboy.
You brute, you dastardly brute.
It's just like, no, you brute. Ah, and he's just so emotional. And then he just like hugs him and he starts crying.
Yeah, the cowboy is just like, there.
Yeah.
There. And just hugs him. Yeah. That's kind of sweet.
Yeah.
Sorry. This is where my notes go. What the hell is going on?
Right. It doesn't make any sense. And then we see them cut to a cafeteria.
Yep, the commissary.
Right. There's a guy in there by the name of Joey who's in full Hitler outfit.
Yeah, yes.
they said, how much longer are they going to need you? And he says.
Only until the bunker scene. Oh, my God, Mel, what did you do?
I do not mind laughing at that joke.
Hitler can go kill himself for all I care.
And then there's like a fight that breaks out. The fight in that previous lot breaks out in here. And there's a couple of jokes that I wanted to bring out. The first is there's a tour guide that's like, this is the eatery. And sometimes famous people eat here. And they're going through as you got this food fight going on. And then when they walk out, they're all covered in pie goop.
They have like one exact face of pie. Mm-hmm. Lamar mm-hmm. is in the cafeteria. Is this another one you're going to point out?
Yeah, he like comes out of the men's room and he sees the fight. And then
someone chucks food next to him. It explodes. He has a little bit on his jacket. And then he walks into the bathroom. Why there's something in the bathroom that will do this, I don't know. But he walks out with a perfect pie face.
Mm-hmm.
And then he like exits the building.
Right. And then he gets into a car.
A taxi.
Yeah.
Get me off the lot.
Yeah. And as it's driving away, everybody else in the fight is coming out of the lot like they're getting away from it. And then we see Bart coming through on his horse.
Yes. And then the taxi gets to the premiere of the movie we're watching because Mel Brooks has no shame.
Yeah.
And I love it. When it comes to this kind of thing.
Right. And Lamar gets out. He is like in the line. He like pushes himself to the front of the line and then he's paying for a ticket.
He tries to pay student prices.
And he's like, student? And she's like, no. And so he's like, gives her that.
In this scene, you can see a temporary film titled Black Bart in the poster case in the background. I wonder if that was maybe not an actual release, but what they were thinking would be the name of the movie.
It's the TV show.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the TV.
They probably tried to get it to be the name of the movie, but there's probably another Black Bart because it's the name of a pirate.
Yeah.
There probably was a Black Bart thing. Shock Talk, if you ever get to this one, let me tell you. Tell me.
So there is a running gag through this movie that we didn't, or we brought it up at the beginning, and it's everybody calling Hedy Lamar. And it doesn't come full circle right at this point, but this is like the second to last joke. And so you see him going into the Chinese theater, and this is where you would have the footprints and the handprints. And you see this woman standing in him, and she's like, "Honey, I'm standing in Hedy Lamar's foot. I'm standing in the footprints of Hedy Lamar." And he's like, "Hedley," and he corrects her as he goes in
because he's been correcting mm-hmm. everybody else the other way,
right? And so he goes in, buys Raisinets, and he sits down. He doesn't like get into the right seat and everything, and he goes and he's watching the movie for Blazing Saddles, and guess who shows up on the screen?
I'm gonna guess Bart
on a horse. Yeah,
yes, at the theater, isn't he?
He's in the filming of it, and then Lamar freaks out and he walks out of the theater, and then Bart is out in the theater as well, and that's when they have the show off. And Lamar's like, "I don't have a gun." He's like, "Then we'll do this man-to-man." He puts his gun down, and then Lamar's like, "I do have a gun." And he pulls it out,
yes, but jerk.
Yeah, but Bart is quicker than him. He ducks down. He grabs the gun as a shot is fired from Lamar. And then Bart shoots him in the dick.
Straight up shoots him in the dick.
It looks like he shot him in the dick. And then he falls down. And Jim and Bart are outside. They regroup outside. And they're like, hey, we should go ahead and see how this movie ends. And as they walk into the theater, you see Lamar over where it says Hedy Lamar.
Uh-huh.
Or Hedy Lamar. And he puts an L in her name. So it's Hedley's, and that's where the joke ends.
Oh my God.
Okay.
So they show Bart walking up to Jim in the corral, and he's eating popcorn out of a movie bucket.
Right, but before that, they both of them sit down,
uh-huh.
and they are in the theater, and then we go back into the film.
Yeah,
and all of the townspeople are like, "Oh, why are you gonna?" Bart makes this big speech about like, "I can't stay too much long. Wherever there's injustice, I have to go out there and I have to protect the weak from the strong." And,
really?
Yeah, they're like, bullshit.
Yeah, I'm just bored. I'm gonna move on.
Yeah, and that's when he sees outside the corral Jim with the popcorn bucket.
Yes, yeah. And he's like, you want to go with me? And he's like, yeah, I do. And you can tell there's like this, not bromance, some people really hate that word, but you can tell that there's this kinship.
Right.
And so they like, they ride off on their horses and they get like halfway across the screen before a car meets them.
Yeah. There's two men who come out of the car.
One takes the horses.
And one is the chauffeur.
And they drive off into the sunset. And then it goes the end.
Yes.
Oh, man. Crazy time. Yeah. The end in the title card font. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
You guys.
Yeah.
I just want to. It's a new year, new me. That's not true.
And you made it all the way through January. Welcome to the new year.
Yeah, let's get through our shocked and applause and get on with like...
Oh, do we have any Sean facts?
Additional Sean facts that I was trying to brush over?
Yeah, we have a couple. The original title, Tex X, was rejected to avoid it being mistaken for an X-rated film.
Yeah.
And did you notice that we left out one thing from Sean facts and that we always remember to do in Sean facts?
Are you talking about the box office?
Yes, my printer ran out of ink where it was telling me what the titles were, where Sean had written them, so I forgot to mention it, but I do have them. And the budget was $2.6 million. That's
brilliant.
What they were aiming for. That is a...
shoestring.
No matter...
Bare bones.
No matter how you do on that, you're going to probably be okay. That's like Mirror Mask was like... $750,000, I think. So based on the $2.6 million budget...
Are we taking guesses?
We are taking guesses.
It did get a lot of nominations. So 2.4, you said?
2.6.
2.6. I'm going to say that it made $15 million. No, wait, hold a second. I'm sorry. Born 9 years after this. I'm going to say that it made $9 million. I'm going to say $7.5 million.
I'm going to say that it made a solid $10
million. Okay.
Yeah. What?
We had a Sean fact earlier in here. I don't remember if you remember me saying here, but it was one of the first movies to exceed $100 million.
Oh. You said that. That was 3 weeks ago, Jen. I don't know what you're talking about. I said right now,
mm-hmm.
$100 million. I remember you saying it. Oh, my God.
It's okay. I mean, I should have done this. You know, definitely first anyway. So it was $119 million.
Before we do our shocked and applaud, can I ask everybody here, what was your favorite joke of the film? Because my favorite was the one where he held himself hostage and he takes himself into the sheriff's and he's like, you are so smart and they are so stupid.
My favorite joke is when he goes, you know, morons. Because it's really easy because I'll be like, I'll be yelling at somebody in my head. I'll be like, there's science that proves this, and I don't know why we're bickering about this. Have you done a peer-reviewed study? A really smart person knows where their knowledge stops and somebody else's knowledge begins, and you trust people whose knowledge you trust. And if you can't verify it by yourself, then you need to have systems in place to verify. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
But then, eventually, I get tired, and I go, ugh, the problem is that I can't make an argument strong enough because they're morons. Sometimes you just need to hear it. I had a guy once tell me, he's like, you know, you're not the crazy one, right? And I was like, oh, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels that way when somebody's like, you know, it's just because they don't get it, because they're dumb.
Yeah, I've known some really incredibly intelligent morons.
Right? I've known some clever people who thought they were smart, and clever and smart are not the same thing.
Uh-uh.
Yeah.
What about you, Jen?
There's a radio show, a radio station here in the Pacific Northwest. I think it's KZOK, but I don't remember. And they will every once in a while throw out like some random audio quote right before they start playing some music. And excuse me while I whip this out is one of the things that they would play right before they play a song. And so for me, it's the most memorable thing because for the longest time, I didn't know what they were. I probably knew that this came from that movie, but it was just because of a small little brief watching on TV and not watching the whole thing. So, but the crowd reaction to that is just classic because they're not really shocked as if he's going to pull out a gun. Mm-hmm. It really looks like he's reaching for his genitals and that they're going to be freaked out by seeing the new sheriff's genitals. But yeah, that's it for me.
All right.
So
we'll just, you want a simple to the fact it on it? We could just, do you want to end on a positive note or no? Do you want to, not positive or negative, do you want to land on a shocked or an applaud moment?
I always like landing on applaud because it's shocked and applaud.
Yeah, that flows. I got you. Mm-hmm. All right, Jen, I'm going to make you go first.
Man. Okay. I really do like the farcical nature of a Mel Brooks film, but for some reason, this ending takes it to some pretty wild extremes. Like it's like it can't figure out how to wrap itself up. So it just breaks the fourth wall and decides to end there. And there's no resolving that kind of fourth wall break. You can't go back into the movie very well after you've broken out of it and it has become a movie within the movie. So, you know, we were watching Gremlins 2 a couple of weeks back and like the film goes all wonky and then you see Gremlins doing shadow puppets.
That's one of the best moments in a film of all time.
Yeah, when done right. And you can tell when it not only breaks the fourth wall, but it breaks the suspension of disbelief. When you are forced to recognize, I am watching a movie, that can be a very, very funny thing. In this case, I think it just went a little too far. And I would have liked to seen a little better resolution with, specifically with Bart and Jim.
Oh, you've seen where they went? Or like...
I mean, I understand the riding off into the sunset and even in a car, but how they sat down and watched the rest of the movie and then headed off.
Fair enough.
I would say like my note is the Mel Brooks as Indigenous chief, though I think it's more like and this is me saying this as a white woman. The racial slurs are like just so many. It's hard for me to see some of the jokes landing because of the fact that they're just like so blatant and so in your face. Though I don't think it's a very good shocked moment because of the fact that this is something that people of color have to deal with even to this day. And it's like, yeah, that jarringness. It's like, yeah, I'm uncomfortable, but I get a step away from it. I don't have to deal with that when I leave the movie.
Yeah. So like if you, by laughing at it, are you taking a privilege you don't intend to take?
Well, I don't want to laugh at it.
So, because I know it relates. Do you remember when the original Kings of Comedy came out?
No.
It's a movie where four different black men comedians.
Oh, okay.
It was a compilation of like their comedy gigs. They did a tour. So it was basically their show. And I think I went with Sean and Maddie. And now, mind you, like this is late 90s. So we're past the this is how a black man walks and this is how a white guy walks sort of jokes. But I mean, it's not crazy far of that. And so you kind of knew from watching Comedy Central and stuff that there was going to be race based comedy in any person of color's routine. Like it's a lot, especially back then, it was a given that you were going to get something of that. And OK, so imagine our paste is walking in and taking a seat, and our general go to back then was third row center. Mm-hmm. And we sat down and the theater filled up and like the joke started and it was funny, like wheezing funny, like hilariously funny. I don't know if the jokes hold. I don't know if I'd think they were funny now, but like 2 decades ago, this was really, really funny. And I remember looking around the room, realizing that we were in the minority in the audience. And I only say that to say we are the three white guys in a room of black people.
Okay.
Who were all looking at us, waiting for us to laugh so that they knew it was okay for them to laugh. Not saying that's cool, but I remember thinking how incredibly awkward. But also, the show was really funny. And so once the people around us knew that we weren't going to be like, how dare they say something about white people?
Yeah.
At least that was my impression. Like, all of us were able to laugh. So the things about this movie that kind of like make me feel really gross.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because we have all this conversation between these subjects now. Like, that's what I want to know. Like, I would like to know a person of color's perspective on any of the different, like, four or five different ethnicities represented in the film. You know, like, I want to know what a gay person would think of looking at this film and being like, well, is it suitable for the time?
Mm-hmm.
Is it not land? You know, like, being in the proximity, like, do you think this is funny? And if you don't, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And if it is a reason that I should be aware of and conscious of, I want to be there. I want to know that. I don't know. Maybe that was just a plug for the original Kings of Comedy. But like, yeah.
Right. What was your shocked moment?
I didn't like this movie as much as I thought I would. Of the four Mel Brooks films I can name off the top of my head, this is the bottom. And I can't tell if it's just because of the jokes that didn't land with me, because we're beyond that now. But I mean, like, other works of his land so dear to my heart. And they also have racial jokes and sex jokes and all of the stuff you see in here. But it's much more refined. It's much more, and I'm sorry to say, palatable. Because I certainly like edgy comedy. But, like, why do I love, you know, Young Frankenstein and Men in Tights? Like, why do I like those so much more? I can't tell you. I don't know. But it leads into my applaud moment.
Right. Go for it.
Okay. So my applaud moment is, it's kind of like they ripped the Band-Aid off. And I'm okay with that. I'm a firm believer in getting it done. So it feels very much, and it, certainly he's not, and I say he because he wrote and directed it, but certainly this is not a piece of work that is the first forage out into the avant-garde world of making fun of taboo subjects. But it is one that felt like a number of those people were included. At least some black guys were there, you know, and got to make that call.
Right.
And for that reason, I think that it cut through a lot of the comedy BS that we waited for. The jokes that landed because, I mean, they were just like sled dogging it through. This movie, for me, for comedy, is like those ice boats, you know?
That break up the ice?
Yeah, like an icebreaker boat. It feels like that. Like, it's very powerful. I can see why it has staying factor, why it's stuck in so many people's minds. Did that lead to my shocked moment? Yes. But do I see it as maybe that it needed to happen? Yes. So that's my applaud moment.
Hey, Jen, what's your applaud moment?
I do agree on the Band-Aid issue. And, you know, this is, I think, by far Mel Brooks's biggest learning lesson. He had to learn a lot of lessons in this movie in order to have the movies that we do have more dearly to our own hearts.
Well, he did teach everybody who could make money off of his style of art.
Yeah. I mean, but in a lot of ways, it's like watching a Richard Pryor or George Carlin stand-up special, in that it's just so jarring for me. Like, we ended up, like, right before this, we turned on a Ron White comedy special.
That was my bad. Sorry.
And it wasn't just that your brother walked in and that face he gets when he has to hear that kind of language. But, I mean, that was
Yeah, but I didn't like it either. And I thought I would. I've enjoyed his work before.
Yeah. Yeah. But it just was, it was just a string of, I mean, it was like people in the audience were accustomed to just laughing at somebody saying an F-bomb, which I can say here because I'm bleeping it.
Yeah, go ahead. Go on, honey. Do it.
Why is a f- laughable? Why is...
Because you're not supposed to say it, you potty mouth.
I think that comes from the fact that a lot of teenagers, at least in our generation, you know, that was not something that you were allowed to say. I mean, even to this day, you can't really say that in school. So when you can, like, grow up, and one of the first things that you get to do as an adult is smoke and swear.
Yeah.
Like, legally, you can technically do that. I mean, like, but even before smoking, you could start swearing, and that's how you, like, prove your clout to your friends. Like, I'm a bad that sort of
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, I remember a girl turning to me once and being like, swearing is used by people who can't be creative with their words. And mm-hmm. That stuck with me because I thought, well, yes, I guess I'm not being very creative. But I think I said the word crap, and crap was my assigned swear word as a child. I was allowed to say that one whenever I wanted. Mm-hmm. Mom's like, yeah, sure, you can say crap. But like,
yeah.
But now that I'm an old person and I can say, f-, I can get real creative with that, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
So I think that I applaud this as a springboard for Mel Brooks. And I do like the fact that he learned how to construct humor to be maybe even a little bit more intelligent in his future films. I don't always necessarily agree with the comedy direction of him, but it certainly has continues to keep my attention. I can watch most of his movies over and over and over again, whereas this one will probably be more of an occasional thing. It is sort of like a Caddyshack for some people. It is like the go-to comedy for some people, and I recognize that and acknowledge it, because in the world of comedy and film, this is really, really up there. It isn't just nominated for things back in its day, but...
Like Sean's notes said, like, it's still making lists of all time.
Right. So maybe even if it's not cultural awareness, for its cultural impact, it's a pretty cool thing.
So my applaud moment kind of bookends Jen's, or shocked moment, because I loved the fourth wall breaks.
All of them?
Well, even the end, but I justify that in kind of a pretentious, like, I'm trying to, you know, do media criticism sort of way, where it's like, media can inform our worldview, and Western movies were going out of style by the time that the 70s rolled around. And like, what's a big thing about Westerns? White people coming and conquering the Wild West. And it wasn't actually like wild, you know, indigenous people lived out there. You also see like a lot of people even to this day, you know, when they like Westerns, they're also kind of people who would think that Black people just need to, you know, pull up by themselves by their bootstraps. And maybe they would think a little bit less kindly on people like Ahmaud Arbery or George Floyd. And maybe they would side with people like Derek Chauvin or more recently, Kyle Rittenhouse. Yeah. So when I see that last fourth wall break, it's more like the movie is bleeding into reality because media can inform our worldview. I mean, we're not violent because we watch a violent movie. But how many times do people go ahead and look at the stereotypes of Black actors and look at those tropes and automatically assign it to Black people who they see in the media?
Oh, let me follow you on this. You want to hear something? Mm-hmm. Let me flip that script on you, because I'm down for it. How many white guys with guns are victorious, virtuous heroes? I'm sorry, America. Y'all been brainwashed. Mm-hmm. Like, the statistics on gun ownership. Here's the thing. I like a gun. I'm not mad about people having them, but I also believe in facts. And the fact that every motorcycle owner you've ever met has been on the survivor bias side of it. Yeah, 80% of all people with a motorcycle are going to get into an accident and seriously injure themselves. Well, obviously that's true because it's statistics provided by sources that are backed and proven. But like, I'm part of the 20%, mm-hmm. right? Not people who own a bunch of guns are, you know, accidental firing and self-harm are like the things that happen in terms of gun injury mm-hmm. the most.
Right.
I mean, other than like mortalizing somebody, which comes in, I'm sorry, probably a far third or even lower down the number of on the charts.
Right.
Right. Like self-harm, accidental fire.
Right.
You know, like.
Right.
Accidental injury of your family member, most likely. Mm-hmm. Like, you go on Facebook, you go on any social media, and you see these people proudly toting. Like, if your household has, like, God, I don't want to make pronouncements. I know lots of responsible, kind, smart gun owners, but I cannot help but believe that they've been influenced by this idea in the media that they are supposed to have the guns because they're the ones who understand the guns.
Right. Most of the people who justify gun ownership uh-huh. are trying to defend their home.
Yes.
Why would they need to defend their home when they live in a suburb and not in the Wild West? If you believed that you had this homestead and you have to defend it from people trying to take it over, that is the mindset of people who believe in this is my own plot of land. And like, nobody can take it. It's mine. I can do whatever I want on it. But when you actually look at, like, logistically speaking, if you want to go ahead and have your own land, how do you know that someone else isn't going to have a bigger gun than you? So then, oh, well, if that's my thought process, then I have to make sure that I have the bigger gun.
Yes.
And then it just kind of escalates because that's their mindset. Instead of thinking about humanity or as a whole, like, I mean, it's globalism and a lot of people don't like the idea of globalism. And I'm not going to go down that road.
All right, hold on a second. Checking in on the scale of 0 to 10.
Oh, we're probably at about a 7 at this point.
Okay, but then you got to bring it in.
Yeah. So basically, instead of seeing the whole world as being a community, you're seeing yourself more as an individual and you have to take care of yourself. But the truth is, when you look at the logistics of individualism versus community, the individual can't actually survive on their own because no man is an island. No human
That's
being is an island because
okay.
you cannot. Because like, let's say that you fall off a ladder in trying to fix your home and nobody's around to help you. You ultimately die.
Okay, this is the thing, Lydia. Exactly. Eggs and axe, exactly
right.
What you say. One of the foremost proof of human beings becoming an agricultural
society.
Right. So when we started putting in homesteads, and I'm talking thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago, one of the things that we proved by fossils that showed that we were evolving was someone was found with a wounded leg. And the proof was there that they had to have been taken care of. The wound was substantial enough that that person would have died if someone had not tended to them. And so what we do for the person who does nothing for us and how we intend to meet the other is what defines us as a society as a whole.
Agreed.
Yeah. Like, I think about that a lot.
And I'm not talking about like you have to be like everybody needs to be a doctor. Like, I will never be a caregiver in the way that your mother was a caregiver as OT.
I'll never be a mother, but I'm an okay caretaker.
But
it's different genres.
I get up early in the morning and I clean dishes. I can do that.
God bless you.
I leave the dishes for me in the morning. I will go ahead and clean them up and put them in the,
that
the dishwasher.
Like a threat.
Leave the dishes for me. So I didn't mind the fourth wall break at the end, but I justified it as being like media can bleed into reality very quickly. But like, and then they just had to bring it back in. And the only way to do that would be for Jim and Bart to go into the movie theater and see how everything ends.
I like the idea that Gene Wilder and
Cleavon Little.
Okay.
I believe so.
I like the idea of them having a conversation with Mr. Brooks and being like, hey, I don't want to ride a horse for an hour into the sunset. What if we just got into a car? Yep.
And then the rest of it is just, well, how do we introduce the car?
Somebody's got it. Well, what are you going to do with the horses once they get in the car?
It is the last of the fourth wall breaks. And it's like, it's kind of meta.
That one's acceptable.
If all of it had been just farcical to that point without any fourth wall breaks.
That would have made no sense.
Yeah. So here we are. At the end of January.
Ooh, you want to give some positive vibes to our applauders? I like sending them out with something nice. I know it probably doesn't make any sense.
You made it through 2021. Here's hoping 2022 doesn't suck nearly as hard.
Nobody promised that 2022 is going to be your year.
Oh, yeah.
Just make it your year, okay, guys? Don't make any pronouncements. That has not worked out well for me.
Don't put it out into the universe. The universe has been like throwing all of our promises back at us.
We hope that the possibility is that you are doing wonderfully, you sexy, sexy creature.
Yeah, beautiful.
And
wink at yourself in that mirror. Next time you see yourself in that mirror, give you a little wink.
I'm personally just motivated this year to be a lot. Well, maybe not even a lot, but just more active in including our social media audience and doing more activities on multiple platforms, more particularly on Twitter. And I've missed some Instagram posts for sure. So I just want to get back into the swing of things. It's been a little difficult with the new job to figure out how all that works out. But please don't feel like we've abandoned you on every podcast file.
Yeah. If you see us out in public and I've given you a business card and awkwardly asked you to listen to my podcast, thanks for being here. This is Naomi McQuaid.
This is Lydia Malcolm.
And this is Jen McQuaid.
And this has been Shocked and Plod. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, yeehaw, plotter. You've now concluded our review of 1974's Mel Brooks classic, Blazing Saddles. We thank you for joining us for Sean Facts, a plot walkthrough, and of course, our shocked and applaudable moments. Looking for more exciting shows to wet your ear whistles? That song from that movie is a podcast journey through the very best and worst of movie songs with Dietrich, Alex, and Ben. And Film Rage is a movie review podcast discussing new releases and streaming. Check out links to these shows in this release's description. Hey, this is your audio engineer and a mind of raging torrent flooded with rivulets of thought cascading into a waterfall of creative alternatives, Jen. Want to make like a shocked and applaud cow and get something branded? We've made brand new stickers and business cards that are a great way to help us share the show with your friends. If we don't yet have your mailing address, you can send it to shockedandapplaud@gmail.com to be sent a new batch in the next few months. We'll be taking a short break and we'll return to you February 8th with a brand new review. It's my pick this month and I can't wait to share it with y'all. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.
Yay! Look how offended Pitch is.
Oh no, she's so offended we were allowed at the end of our podcast.
Yeah, sorry, Pitch.
Where's the feline representation?
Cats 2019.